Okay, I think we can get started. Erev Tov, everybody, and we'll start class number 42. Are we? Is this class 42?
42, and I thought we'd go to like 55. It's not going to be that. We're only about, when we'll be done tonight, we'll be 40 pages from the end.
Okay.
So I have a whole pile of things here I want to get to. Well, because I don't want to have them left over. So let me give the date. It's March 15th, 2021. So let me just do a number of things before we start. I do believe this class we will get to the Lubavitcher Rebbe. My mother keeps asking me. I first want to go back to last class. I didn't have this picture handy. Thank you to David Eisen for showing it to me here. Where is it? On my screen here. Here it is. You should see it now. Can you see it? I don't have my other thing. Okay, so this is, he's a shochet from Morocco. And what is he holding there? He's holding a partridge. And I have the letter you can see on Rabbi Zivotofsky's website about the testifying that he used to shecht it. So it's a kosher bird. So if anyone wants to eat the partridge, be my guest. Just getting my other screen up in here. A couple other things I want to show you. I listened to the video. And no one corrected me on this point. I couldn't believe I said it. We were talking about Italy, and I said that the only two communities, oh, hold on, let me close this off here. But the only two communities are Rome and Livorno. Of course, there's Milan. Milan's the second largest community after Rome. And you have Chabad there, and you have Sephardic Jews, and very, very nice community as well. What else do I want to show you? Oh, you'll be very happy, Rabbi Kelman, with this. I think I will send this to you. Hold on. In case you didn't have it, I know you were very concerned about it, but hold on. Where is it? Oh, boy. I'll get it here. I have lots of, you see all the stuff I want to show you. If you recognize who that is. Hold on. Here it is. A mass that's kosher to Pesach. In case you were wondering, there you go. Maybe because there's kidneys or something in it, but it hasn't reached America yet. But here, this was taken in Israel last week, and it's under the Chasam Sofer Hashgacha. It's a big hashgacha out of Bnei Brak, I believe. And you can there get your kosher to Pesach. COVID mask, anyone, in case you're wondering why you need it, well, chalk that up to all the other things that have hashgachas that aren't needed. But look, Jews need parnassa, so they come up with these things. What can I tell you? I had nice correspondence with someone, and here's the story. I give full names. You'll hear when I ask or when people tell me. Other than that, I only give first names unless I feel there's no reason. Then I don't give any names. But one of you, who actually I forgot who it was, I won't mention a name. We're talking about this thing I was speaking about Gemara only being for the elite. So he asked me, is that something that's I think only recently or in the olden days that everyone would be expected to learn? And I actually think this is the way it always was, and I'll give you the proof of this, unless you think this is not a good proof. I want to show you what the Midrash says. I have too many things. I have to close them out now. Here's the Midrash in Vayikra Rabbah, and it says as follows. You see where the marker is here? It's saying, but noheg shebaolam, the practice in the world is elaf bnei adam nichnasim lamikra. 1,000 people go and study mikra. Yotzei man mea, about 100 of them are 1/10 of them are successful. Of this 100, mea la mishnah, 100 will study mishnah. Yotzei mehen asara, 10 will come out successful. And of those, asara la talmud, 10 will study talmud. Yotzei mehen echad, only one will be successful. So what we see among this is that already, even in the time of the Midrash, they're talking about how for the average person, and by and that's so they give a drasha here, as I recall, yeah, Adam Echameof Matsasi, from Koheles. So the, you see already in the Midrash period, which is taking us back, I don't know, what are we, 6th century, 7th century? I'm not concerned when it was actually put together, edited, but these traditions go way back. And they're already saying there that of 1,000 people, one you'll have who who's Yotze. I guess that means to be an expert, maybe to give halachic decisions. But you see already out of 1,000, only 10 of them go on to study Gemara. So we're doing a lot better than they were doing in the time of the Midrash, if you look at it that way. Okay, Matthew Miller. He called my attention to the following. Remember I mentioned Rabbi Mazuz, he said about YU. He heard that there's a guy at YU who wrote a book showing how everything derives from the Hebrew language, English also, all the words. I didn't know what he was referring to. Thank you, Matthew Miller. Someone at YU, I guess is from the 70s, Isaac Elchanan Moseson. I don't know where he is now, but if you, let's see, let me close this up here, show you what he wrote. This is what Rabbi Mazuz was referring to. He actually published a book on the topic, and you can buy it. The Word, the dictionary that reveals the Hebrew source of English. And that's Isaac Moseson. That's Matthew Miller called my attention to another thing. Let me get his paper here. This is from a sermon. If you go to YU, you have all the sermons of Rabbi Lamb. He was incredible. He wrote everything down. He typed it all up. And now they've published many of them. But here is one of his sermons. Say goodbye to the chazan and the mask. What Matthew pointed out, which is interesting, is that he wrote out the words. You see here, Vayikach Moshe et Matei HaElohim biyado. He wrote it, he typed it out. He actually wrote God's name, which you're allowed to do, but you can't throw it out then. And we're accustomed not to do that, but it's significant or interesting at least that Rabbi Lamb, since he's writing Torah, he didn't feel a problem in writing out, it's not the Tetragrammaton, but he didn't feel the problem with writing it out. Two more things. Mel asked a question last week, and then we're going to get back to Bavor, and that'll be the last thing. Mel asked, I mentioned the Rav Elio ben Amozig, who talks about, it's actually in his Eimat Mafkia. If you look in his Eimat Mafkia, volume 2, page 2b, he speaks about all these things that he thinks that it's Gilgal. So, for example, there's a Talmudic opinion that, what does they say? Lavan is, I forget who it is. I'll read you some of the things he has here. Koresh is Daryavash. And who is Lavan? I forgot who. Lavan is, I forgot which who I identify. Lavan is Bilam, yeah. So how could Lavan, and he says it's all Gilgal. And then there's the one of Pinchas and Eliyahu. That's the one we spoke about. Now, Rabben Amozig is not the first one to say Pinchas is Eliyahu. Already the Zohar says that. The question is, what does that mean? That's what Mel asked me. And there's a lot of different interpretations of it. There are some who think it's Gilgal. In fact, before Ben Amozig, I found that Menachem Rekanati, he's in the 4th century, I believe, he says that. But the Radbaz doesn't say that. The Radbaz simply says that Eliyahu is from the same Shoresh Neshama. I guess that's the term they use. So they have some spiritual characteristic. Incidentally, when you deal with reincarnation, I got an email today. All the Chabad do at the same time. Hold on a second. Let me show you something here. All the Chabad. Yes. Okay. I found it on my computer here. I got the same thing. All the Chabads all over the world deal with. They have these classes that the experts in Crown Heights develop, and then they send it out, and they send them all source material. So this week, it's lesson number 5, reincarnation, more than a fascinating topic. Judaism provides a practical way to imagine this mystical process and explains why it is important both to departed souls and our lives today. This isn't the sort of thing that we'd have in our typical modern Orthodox shul, but Chabad, as we saw in Kabbalah, it's essential. So therefore, they're doing it. One more point before we go on, take you back to last class. I said about this phrase, can anyone just bavorn? It's right here. And I said, I've never heard that as yeshivish. And some of you wrote to me that maybe it means, because that's the word for warn. Like, can anyone just warn? But that, what sense would that make? It's warn is hasra. We say give hasra. But three people emailed me and they pointed out that I did not know this. I guess maybe why you trained Rosh Yeshiva don't use the term, but it definitely is a term, although it not the way he uses it. Can anyone just bavur? So, for example, Yehuda sends me, you would say, for example, the Beis Yosef already bavurned the Lavush's question. What does it mean to bavorn the question? It means to address or to account for. Morty said, emailed me that it means also to raise an issue. Bezalel says it's to bavorn something is to preclude it. Morty says it's to bring attention to something. So I said that last class, maybe someone will come up with the answer. And I don't think they say that at Gush, but there is such a thing, bavorn, in yeshiva circles. So, which I did not know, at least in yeshiva circles I was in. Maybe I did hear of it, but I did not remember it. Okay, that is enough for today. I have some other things, but I want to continue with where we are, because we have good stuff, as always. And we're picking up in the Sefer on page 311. Siman Kuf Mem Dalad. And there's a couple things here. Well, first, I don't need to get into much details, but Rabbi Mazuz begins as follows. This is interesting in his letter to me. This is from 2017. He says, I received your letter. I didn't have time to reply from all the, you know, busy work troubles. Kol minei anashim b'michtavim u'mailim. Everyone sending letters and emails. And what are they saying? They had a problem with me. Lama ani maskir shelot b'inyanei emunah l'hashiv aleihem. Why am I raising all these questions about philosophical matters? And he says they want to itmon rosham b'chol. They want to put their head in the sands, just like the ostrich. And they want to know why I'm quoting Aristotle in Hebrew is Aristo, and Einstein and Bialik. And he says they forgot the Rambam and Rav Sadia Gaon. And he says, I decided not to give the Saturday Night Shiur anymore, which has been going on probably for 20 years. But then everyone starts sending me more than 100 letters I received from all the groups, from the Charedim, from the Datim, from the Chilonim, telling me that the Shiur is important, so I'm continue to do it. Now, this letter deals with a few different things. I only want to focus on one. I'll briefly mention just... actually, two things I want to focus on. It began, I just point something out to him. Rabbi, the Rambam wrote, we have an ethical will of the Rambam to his son, in which he says all sorts of unusual things. He attacks the scholars of France as, you know, in a really, really bad way. He shows that he likes Ibn Ezra. There's a number of problems in this letter, and the scholars are all in agreement that this is a forgery. It's not even a doubtful letter, it's a forgery. And if you look in Rav Shalat, he explains why it's a forgery. In fact, the text we have, part of it, we even have it in an Italian text, which was stitched together with the second part. And so there's no question it's not real. It's not authentic. But Rabbi Mazuz, for some reason, and he writes me a number of paragraphs saying, no, it's authentic. It's the Rambam's approach, and it's the Rambam's language. And as for the attack, the scholars of France, well, of course he attacked them because he learned that they believe in God has a physical form and all these things. And he goes on and on. You can read it, but it's not true. With all due respect to Rabbi Mazuz, there's no doubt among the scholars that this so-called ethical will, if you ever see it quoted, it's not authentic to the Rambam. It's that someone, for whatever reason, decided to write it. But then it gets interesting because in one of his Saturday Night Shiurim, he quoted from a book called, let me read you exactly what he quoted from here. The book is called Eov Kamotshehu, Job as it is. And he says as follows, he quotes this book and he says, which I saw, he says that in this book, Sefer Eov Kamotshehu, Shara'iti Lefisha, Nilcham Imahem, the author goes to battle against these biblical critics. So I wrote to Rabbi Mazuz that apparently you don't know who wrote the book. He says that in the book, Eov, Kamochahu, Nilchamu Yohem, he goes, the author battles with them. So who wrote this book, Eov, Kamochahu? The same person who wrote the book, I think it's called Yeshaya, Isaiah, Echad Hayah, was one against the idea that of second Isaiah. So let me tell you about one of the most fascinating families. They've all passed away, but there are probably people listening to us right now who at least know some of them. So I'll introduce you by doing everyone till we get to the star of the show, the person, the author of this book. But what family are we referring to here? Well, first, does anyone know Mordechai Margolios? He's a great Talmudic scholar. He wrote books, Encyclopedia of Gedol Yisrael. He edited the standard edition of Vayikra Rabbah, Leviticus Rabbah. He published a number of other things. And he taught at the seminary for many years. He was married to a very interesting woman. But before we get to this woman, Rachel Margoliot, let's talk about who her family is. The family is the Kolodetsky family. And they had three sons that I know of, and at least that became famous, and one daughter. Well, one of the sons is Rav Yitzhak Kuwitz. Yitzhak Kuwitz was chief rabbi of Jerusalem until he died in 2003, so a great posek, an important figure. They had another brother, and his brother was Tzvi Kuwitz. Tzvi Kuwitz, it says he learned in Sabaka. He ended up in America. He wrote a number of books. One of his books was on... let's see, do I have it here? Oh, the confrontation, the existential thought of Rabbi Joseph B. Soloveitchik. He taught at YU. But he's famous because he wrote something else. He wrote a book called, an essay, not a book, a short story. Yossel Rockover Talks to God. What happened was in 1946, I think it was, he was sent by the Sochnut to Israel, to be a Sochnut of Israel, to go to Argentina for Latin America to encourage Aliyah. And while there, he wrote in Yiddish for a Jewish newspaper there, as you can see it right here, a fictional story that deals with theodicy of, having faith in the Holocaust, even though you're suffering so much. The problem was that, as it says here, a few years after it published, someone picked it up. It was translated into English and Hebrew. And it was passed off and it was reprinted in numerous places as an actual story. A true story, which it wasn't. It was a made-up story, and it took him about 25 years before he was actually able to reclaim ownership, because this was published all over the place as a true story of Yossel Rockover. Now it's achieved its renown. It's a wonderful story. If you haven't seen it, as it says, it was published in an edition with what does it say here? Slim volume with afterwords by Emmanuel of Levinas and Leon Wieseltier. Leon Wieseltier is making a comeback, by the way, if you know what happened to him. So it all depends if you believe that people should be condemned forever, but he's definitely making a comeback. He started an online journal of intellectual opinion. So that's sibling number two, Tzvi Kuwitz. And the third sibling is Chaim Kuwitz, also yeshiva trained, a business person. He's known in the yeshiva world because he was actually in the Irgun, but he wrote a book, here you see it, Hachoza Milita, which is a description from up close, their families were very close, of the Chazon Ish. And this book was controversial for the simple reason that Chaim Kuwitz spoke about something that everyone knows, but no one ever wanted to speak about, but everyone knows it. Subsequently, it's been spoken about that the Chazon Ish did not have a good marriage, that his wife was somewhat significantly older than him. In fact, he married her when he found out that he was deceived on how old she was, but he says he's not going to allow a Jewish girl to be embarrassed this way. But they did not have, you listen to them now, there's a few more than a couple other people written about it. Like she would scream and this, and it wasn't a good marriage. So Kuwitz writes about it, their marriage. And So, of course, everyone wants to read about it because everyone wants to know about the Chazon Ish, but then everyone attacks him because he shouldn't have written about it. But everyone who's attacking him, they want to read about it because it's interesting. Yeshiva students would climb through the Chazon Ish's window. He would stay in the room with the door closed, and he'd open the window and he'd speak to them from the window, or they would actually climb in because his wife wouldn't allow anyone in the house. It was a strange situation. And so he writes about it. So it's a famous book. It was only reprinted one time. And I was fortunate to find a copy in Israel. And then they had a sister. And Litvisha family with a daughter. And here she is, Rachel Kulitz, or when she was married, Rachel Margolios. She only passed away in 2009. She lived in America for many years. Remember what I told you, that her husband was teaching at the seminary for, I think, throughout all the 60s to the early 70s. And look at her books. So she wrote Echad Haya Yishayahu and Eov Kamoshahu, and then she wrote another book about, and these are very interesting books. She is a woman who is a Torah scholar, who's educated, who's writing books before this was popular, before Nachama Leibowitz. Around the same time as Nachama Leibowitz, but she's writing like from a Torah academic perspective. She's someone who all these women at Migdal Oz and Nishmat and Lindenbaum, they should know about her. Her picture should be on the wall because they're all following in her footsteps without even knowing who she was. So that's Rachel Margolios from the Kulitz family. So Rabbi Mazuz, so I write to him, I said that you said that that Nilcham, that he went to war against, you know, some of these critical theories. Did you not know that it's actually not a man who wrote the book? It was a woman who wrote the book. So it should be Nilchama. And he says as follows to me. he says, I knew that she was Rabbanit Rachel Margolios, the wife of Dr. Mordechai Margolios and the sister of Rabbi Yitzhak Kulitz and also the sister of Chaim Kulitz, the author of Achoz Melita on the Chazon Ish. He doesn't know Tzvi Kulitz, but Tzvi Kulitz, again, was in America for all these years. And then he says, why did he say Nocham? He says, nevertheless, I wrote B'loshon Zachar, because of tznius reasons, that people should not say that I'm mitvakeach imisha, that here I'm picking on a woman, I'm arguing with a woman. And therefore, he says, you should read the sentence as follows. He says, I intended the book. So when it says, uvasefer Eov kamochahu, nilcham imahem, what is it? It's the book is disputing with them, not the person. But he says that he thinks for tznius reasons, it's not good to have a man... hey, today they'll say it's mansplaining or things like that. But look, if you're writing an academic work, you need to be able to, men should be able to criticize women and vice versa. But I don't know if this is a Victorian thing. Or I don't know what he means by tzniut, because I don't know how is it a violation of tzniut, but to criticize a woman's writing. But and he says because they would that they would not say that I'm arguing with a woman. Maybe the whole idea that you're disputing, I don't know. But so he knew that it's written by a woman. And if you haven't heard of Rachel Margolios, like I said, that she has not been given the due that she deserves, that she's writing top level stuff. I'll give you the date. Let me see if it gives the dates. 54 is her book on Yishayahu, and the book on Eov. It's showing it 1981. Yes, that's later. But so that's Rachel Margolios. Then the next part of the letter is of interest also, especially because we're coming to Pesach. We have another thing of interest coming to Pesach too, today as well, hopefully. All you see in the letter is he says, I've never seen this book, Pele Yoetz's Tshuvot. So let me explain what it is. I explained in the note. Rabbi Mazuz says as follows. He published an article in Or Torah in 2014. I can send it to anyone who's interested. It's called Binyan Kibbutz B'chol HaMoed, regarding the matter of washing clothes during Chol HaMoed. Because if you look at the sages said, you're not supposed to do the laundry in Chol HaMoed. And he says that this was in their time. that it would all be, they would mechabsim biyad, they would do it all by hand at the river, uvetircha rabba, sha'ot al gabe sha'ot, it would take forever. And therefore, people would hold off, they would keep the wash until Chol HaMoed, because they're so busy preparing for the Chag that they'd wait till Chol HaMoed and do it. And Chazal did, Dafka didn't want to do that, so they said, that's the reason you can't do it on, you have to do it beforehand. But he says, today, it's not a tircha, it's no big deal, you just throw it in the wash, and it takes 1 minute. And so he has a whole piece here, 2 pages, explaining why it's halachically, there's no problem. And but then in the end, he says, nevertheless, most of the achronim forbid it even today. And then he says, but if you're already washing the kids' stuff, you're allowed to wash the kids' stuff. You can throw in the adult stuff as well. But he thinks that you can wash everything. Nevertheless, he says, I don't want people to rely on me because I'm Yirei Hara. I'm one of the people who doesn't like to make halachic rulings. And if they don't agree with me, then this is just be halacha v'lo l'maisa. Now, this is an old question. What do you say when you see a psak from someone where they give all the reasons why something is halachically permissible, but then in the end they say, don't rely on me? You can look in the Sdei Chemed. He has a whole section on this where he discusses it. Some hold that basically you accept what the posek says, and the part where he says, don't rely on me, you say it's just modesty, and you don't have to pay attention to that. Others say that no, it means that really he's not supposed to be relied upon. This, I think maybe most people apply adopt the first approach. One of the most famous tshuvot in modern times actually has that caveat. Rav Jacob Ettlinger, the Binyan Sion, he has this tshuva saying that today Jews who are Mechal Shabbos, the Jews he's speaking about, they maybe will go to shul in the morning or they'd have a Shabbos meal, but they still would be Mechal Shabbos. They're not a Mechal Shabbos like the Gemara speaks about. From the Gemara speaks of Mechal Shabbos, someone who rejects God, he's a heretic. No, we see they're not. They just, I coined the phrase, they're God-fearing Sabbath violators. And we all know people like that. And Rebecca Vettlinger says, we don't apply to them this idea that you can't count them in a minyan and they'll make the wine no good and all that. It's a new category because we're dealing with new type of people. Well, if you look before the tshuva, it says that the tshuva from this point on are just, they're not halacha l'maisa. And yet everyone has relied on this in practice. Now, Rabbi Mazuz returned to this in 2017 in his weekly Torah sheet. Torah, I don't know what you call them. They call them sheets in Israel. And he says as follows. This is Sukkos in 2017. He says he goes through the sources again. And then he says that it shouldn't be a problem today because you just put it in the washing machine. It shouldn't be a problem. But then he says, but we don't abolish the gezeira of the chachamim. We don't have the authority. But then he says, they told me that Rabbi Sheinberg did permit it. Rabbi Chaim Pinchas Sheinberg was a great, great Torah sage from America. He studied, his name was George, incidentally. He studied with Rav Soloveitchik. Rav Soloveitchik had a yeshiva, Yeshivas Hechel Rav Chaim Halevi in Boston for a few years. I met someone, he passed away. He taught economics at TB. He wasn't religious when I met, I shouldn't say he wasn't religious. He wasn't, I guess, Orthodox. He taught economics at George Mason University. He was in the Rav's Kollel in the 40s, and right when the Rav started being at YU. And he told this story, which I don't think I wrote about it, but it's, I don't think it's been picked up. And I believe him. This isn't some hagiography. He says that they were sleeping in like one of the shuls. They gave him a place to sleep. The Rav woke them up at like, I don't know, 2 a.m. or something, and said to them, I have the answer to the kasha. And he actually made them get up to tell them what the answer to the question that he had was. But he says Rabbi Sheinberg permitted doing the wash on Chol HaMoed because he says the whole gezeira of the Chachamim was when they didn't have a washing machine. And people would have to work hard. And then, but Rabbi Mazuz says, nevertheless, since the tradition is not to wash it, even though before he says it should, he doesn't want to permit it. And then he says, and then he repeats what he said before, that only if you're already doing, let's say you're washing underwear, so then you throw things in, or if you're washing kids' stuff, but not the dafka, take, let's say, your pants or your shirt, if you have other stuff, I guess. And then he says here, I have not found anyone who has permitted it explicitly. He's not talking about Rav Scheinberg. I think he means in writing. Oh, yeah, because he says, but except for Rav Scheinberg, who said it, but no one, Baal Peh, but nothing in print. So I wrote to him, there's a sefer that was put out by a Rabbi Stolman, Aviad Stolman. I don't know what he's doing now. He's a Talmud Chacham and also an academic scholar. For a while, Rabbi Kelman, as I said, he gets all the great people. He had Yoel Finkelman speaking. I believe Rabbi Stolman had Yoel Finkelman's job a couple of years ago at the library. And he published a little volume of Shelet and Shuvot called Pele Yoetz. And in there, he makes the case that exactly this, that Rabbi Mazuz didn't want to do halacha maisa, that today's day and age, there's no issue. So I wrote to him this. I don't know today what the rabbis tell you. I can say as follows. I showed it to Rav Herschel Schechter, the tshuva, and Rav Schechter said as follows. This is like literally word for word. It makes perfect sense. I said, so then can I say that you agree? Halacha maisa, you matter it? And Rav Schechter said, that I have to think about. In other words, he wouldn't matter it. He said it makes perfect sense, but he wouldn't. For Rav Schechter, it's all halacha v'lo maisa. I asked him, I wanted to know. So do you permit? And he says, no, we have to think about it some more. So then I had my friend in Lakewood show it to Rav Abadi, because this is the same sort of thing that Rav Abadi, I was certain Rav Abadi would say 100% it's mutter. Because this, if you know the way Rav Abadi works, this is the exact sort of thing that he would say. He's always coming up with ideas because it's a different circumstance. But he said no. He said he doesn't accept it. And I'm not sure why, but so you can ask your local rabbi. And that's Simon Kuf Mem Dalet. Let us now move on to Kuf Mem Hey. And I'm going to we return to this individual. Let me get the screen up here again. I lost my screen here. So we'll say goodbye to Rachel Margoliot. There must be people listening to us or if we're listening later on YouTube who knew her because she would have lived on the Upper West Side. In fact, let me hold on a second. I'll tell you exactly what years her husband taught at the seminary. I think we might even have people who, I know we do, who listen. I don't know if on live with us now who went to the seminary, because someone just emailed me last week that he was in seminary in the 70s. So it said from 1958 until his death, he taught at the seminary till 68. So for 10 years at least, they were living on the Upper West Side, because all those seminary people lived on the Upper West Side. The seminary in the 50s and the 60s had such great scholars. It's unbelievable the sort of people they had. And Mordechai Margoliot wasn't even the top of the line. He's like second. You have Lieberman and you have Ginsburg. Other people they had there, Halkin and Spiegel, I think, taught there. And people like Dimitrovsky, Abramson, who were giants at the seminary, they were like the second level people, even Halivni, he was also second level during those years. So I don't think you ever had such a concentration of great scholars in one institution as you had at the seminary, let's say, in the 50s. Let's see, Lewis Ginsburg dies. Let's see, hold on a second. You had both... Lieberman and Ginsburg dies in 53, but even after Ginsburg dies, they still had amazing people. Okay, we're going to return to a person that we saw earlier on, Rabbi Yitzhak Ratzabi, the great Yemenite posek. And I asked him a question that first at the end of the tshuva, I'll mention this at the end, because I asked them the same thing I asked other people when I was working at Brandeis before Smicha. People would call me rabbi, do I need to protest? And he said, no. He said that, in Yesh Bazet Toel Ruchani, Tochal Ishtok, if you feel that it has a spiritual value, you can do it. And that's why when I see people, you often find people who are called rabbi, and you know for a fact, or at least I know for a fact, that they never got smicha, but they're doing a good job. I guess it's fine. And he says as follows, and the title rabbi also has been used in opposition to the Karaites. So therefore, if you're called rabbi, it's in English, we refer to it as rabbinite. But in Hebrew, I guess, you refer to the non-Karaites, you can call them rabbis. So that's what he said. But that the main question I asked him was as follows. And that has to do with the issue of, we're going to be having it soon on Pesach. Now, let me pull up the screen again for you. I'm going to show you Gemara and Pesachim. Really, you see the in Brachos, you see the... Hold on a second. I have to find the Gemara here. I don't know what happened to my Gemara in Pesachim 110b. Okay, I got it now. Let me share my screen with you. I don't know if you've heard of Zugot. Zugot is, there was this idea that if you did things in pairs, like 2, 4, that it would be problematic because the demons come out and they could cause you problems if you do things in pairs. So the Gemara speaks about this. And then it actually says if you're not particular about it there, the demons don't come after you if you don't care about it. And in Eretz Yisrael, they weren't particular. But then the Gemara raises the following question. It says, where is it here? I believe it's, I can't, I thought it was here on 111A, but maybe it's before. Basically, they ask yourself about, they're wondering, hold on, I got to find the Gemara here. Here it is. I think, they want to know about, we have the four cups. So how could we have the four cups? Where is it? Anyone know what daf it's on here?
I thought it was 112, but I couldn't.
112. Okay, 112.
That's what I thought, but I really have to check.
Yeah, Leil Shimurim. Is it 112?
Maybe I'm wrong, but
let me see. No, that's a different that's Shavriri and everything, but. Okay, well, I'll say it outside. I thought it was, I closed it by mistake. I want to show you, though. Anyone have it here? Anyone know about where the Gemara is? Just call it out. We'll find it quickly. I thought it was... I thought it was Kufyat Aleph, Ahmed Aleph.
Bet.
It's Ahmed Bet?
I think so.
Okay, yeah, we got our Talmudic scholars here.
It was this past Shabbos.
It's Kufyat Aleph Amad Beis.
Kuftes Amad Beis.
Kuftes Amad Beis. Okay, there you go. Kuftes Amad Beis. Okay. I want to show you this Gemara because you'll think about it then tonight in a short while when we're. At the Seder, Kuftes Amud Beis.
And the two dots.
Yeah, no, I just want to have the English. So, here it is. Yeah, very good. Okay. So the Gemara says that you shouldn't do things in pairs. And then they said, we call it Leil Shimurim. So, this is a night, Passover night is guarded from demons, and therefore you don't need to worry about pairs. And then they give other reasons, because what about the cups? We have, here it says, like, how could the sages establish a matter through which one will come exposed to danger? Because it says you shouldn't eat pairs. How can you have, four cups of wine? And they give reasons, different reasons. The cups are separated, you don't combine them, or it's a Leil Shimurim. So you have this idea of Zugot. Rav Avram ben Arambam. Well, even before we get to Rav Avram ben Arambam, the Rambam himself doesn't mention anything about Zugot. And this isn't the only place Zugot is mentioned in Pesachim. It's mentioned in Brachos also, where it says that you shouldn't say grace after meals over what they call the cup of punishment. And they say, what's that? That's the second cup. And Rashi explains there that Zugot cause harm with demons. Now, if you look in the Rambam mentions nothing about Zugot. And everyone has always assumed that that's because the Rambam doesn't include things dealing with superstitions. There's nothing in demons. The Rambam cuts these all out. And not to mention the fact that the Gemara already says that in Eretz Yisrael, they were not careful about this. However, we have a new book. This book, it's not so new. It's from Rav Avram ben Arambam, published in 1989. It's called The Sefer HaMaspik, Le'ovdei Hashem. And it's we have two volumes of it. The first volume was published, I think, in the 40s already. It's called The Highways to Perfection. It's published in English, and it was translated by a rabbi in Baltimore called Samuel Rosenblatt. Samuel Rosenblatt was the son of the great Chazan, Yossele Rosenblatt. But he was the rabbi in Beth Tefillah in Baltimore, also Johns Hopkins PhD, and he translated it. And then this next section, which now has appeared in English as well, there's a rabbi in Miami who translated it, but this is from the Hebrew for the Arabic. And you see something amazing in here, which was completely new, in which Rav Avram ben Arambam records an oral teaching of his father. These books, the Sefer HaMaspik, are important because we hear stuff about the Rambam that we did not know about. And according to Rav Avram ben Arambam, the Rambam, it's not that he didn't regard Zugot as superstition. That's why on the contrary, he says that the prohibition of Zugot is directed against dualist ceremonies. In other words, it's not that we abstain from Zugot, as Rashi explains, because we're worried about demons. No, on the contrary, the sages were concerned about these dualist type ceremonies, which I guess means that if you believe like Zoroastrians, you have the god of light, the god of darkness, so you'll do things twice, once to satisfy this god, once to satisfy the other god. So the way that Rav Avram says that the Rambam understood all these things about Zugot as having to be directed against against these dualist type of ceremonies. Now, why doesn't the Rambam include it? I guess because there's no more dualism. They don't need to keep people far away from them. But that's what the Rambam says. The Meiri has an interesting perspective. He thinks that people were so attached to this that the sages, since it was connected to, let's say, idolatrous type things, the sages moved it away, kept the practice, but moved it into like a kosher direction. Now, I asked, the problem was that the translation is difficult and it's not really clear what he's saying. Subsequently, though, people have explained it the way I just told you. So I asked Rabbi Mazuz, asked Rabbi Ratzabi about this, and he says that it does appear to be a problem in the Arabic, and he doesn't think that the fact that they didn't care about Zugot in the land of Israel, that would be enough of a reason to say the Rambam doesn't follow it. But that's the significant point, is we can leave out Rabbi Ratzabi, is that Rav Avram and Rambam tells us that the Rambam's position on Zugot, he didn't think it was superstition. He thought it was the sages legislating to keep people away from practices, this doubling that was done for idolatrous reasons. So that's a very significant addition by the Rav Avram and Rambam. The rest of the letter is, hold on a second here. I asked him about this book, Shemos Kodesh V'chol. It says on the title page, the Rambam wrote it. And this is with Rav Sabi's commentary. All the throughout the Torah, which names are like Elohim, is it holy or is it not? I have to say that today the scholars do not believe that this was written by the Rambam. Although I'm not the one to pass judgment, leave it to the great scholars. But what I wanted to send him was material relating to this. But I have to say now, I have a whole section of my library, which is all Maimonidean stuff. And I keep it there because it's quasi-Maimonidean, but we assume it's not by the Rambam. So that's the Shemos Kodesh V'chol. That is the end of Kuf Mem Hei. The next tshuva, which we won't do, but I just want to tell you a story, is Kuf Mem Vav, page 316. It's written to me by a Rabbi Yitzhak Hershkovitz. So who is Yitzhak Hershkovitz? I actually met him. How did I meet him? Well, first let me tell you where he comes from. He is the son of this person. There was a great, great rabbi named Ephraim Fischel Hershkovitz. He was a Kreuzenberger Chassid. He died in 2017. Here's his picture. he didn't write, although he writes many approbations, but he was a great Talmud Chacham, he was a leading posek, Ephraim Fischel Hershkovitz, for the Koisenbergers, he was like their leading posek. So how did I meet him? So this is a good story. It's worth telling you. When I lived in the Upper West Side, I used to go to the seminary a lot. That's where all the great libraries were. I have no idea what's going to be. They just redid the seminary library. You can go online, you can see a video. But I'm very skeptical about the future of libraries because now that I have Otzar Chachma on HebrewBooks.org, you can access 80,000 books by your fingertips. So I assume you'll need rare book rooms and things like that. But is there any future for libraries? I don't know. It's sad because I spent many great times there. But one of the times I was there, I was in the rare book room because I like to look at manuscripts and uncover things. I like to spend my time in archives. So I realize that for the average person, that's not exactly something fun to do, but that's what I like to do. And I go all over the world to go to the different archives and then see the sites, but I love the archives. So I'm there. And then you have a rabbi there with a long white beard with two other people with him. And Rabbi Jerry Schwartzbard, who's the director of the rare book room, he comes over to me and says, "Do you know who that is?" I said, "No." He goes, "That's Rabbi Ephraim Hershkovitz." And, I knew the name, of course, great, great postsake. And it reminded me of a story that Rabbi Rakefet has told many times, and he even wrote it up in his autobiography, which is called From Washington to Washington, something like that. Meaning from, I guess, where he grew up I don't even know what to Israel, I guess. I forgot the title of the book, so I don't know what it refers to, but something like
Washington Street to Washington Avenue, something like that. He grew up in the Bronx on Washington Street, and he moved to Israel. There's Washington. Oh,
okay.
That was what it meant.
So he tells the story there. He grew up in the Bronx, and one of the big rabbis in the Bronx was Rabbi Moshe Bick. Rabbi Moshe Bick, the Bick family, they have his nephews at Gush, is one of the rabbis at Gush from the Bick family, and he's a student of Moshe Soloveitchik, an American, and an important rabbinic family. He became the posek of Borough Park, Ashkenaz, Musach Ashkenaz. And that's Rav Moshe Bick. His cousin, Avram Bick Shauli, the one who edited Rav Yaakov Emden's stuff, was a complete communist. I wrote about this. A frum Jew, but an actual communist. It's a long story. I can tell you another time about him. But Rakefet tells the story. He's in the seminary once. And he sees Rav Moshe Bick, and he says to Rav Moshe Bick, "Kohen Beves HaKfaros? You know, a Kohen in a cemetery here?" And you have to know also the seminary, they used to call it in a derogatory fashion, the cemetery. That was one of the ways they would call it. But by saying, I don't know if he had that in mind when he said it, or just that, what's someone like you, Rav Moshe Bick, doing in a place like the seminary? The truth is that anytime you went to the seminary, you saw Hasidim with payas and long black coats. They all go there because it was an open library, unlike YU, where it's a closed stack. You can't just get in. You need to go get a card and all that. Seminary, anyone could go in. In fact, it became such a problem. I assume it's so-called from Jews trying to liberate the books. They had to put in the late 90s, I think it was, or early 2000s, like these metal detectors. Because all these books started disappearing, and so they had to put in something to prevent it. So you always would have Talmid Chachamim. But Rav Moshe Bick's reply was, you know, if the seminary has importance for him, I shouldn't see it. So Rav Ephraim Hershkovitz was looking at manuscripts in the manuscript room. You know, the money, Ivan Bosky gave a lot of money to the seminary. And after his scandal, they took his name off the front. They asked him, could they take his name off the front? But they never took his name off the inside. If you went up to the fifth floor, you had Ivan Bosky's name right there, which I guess is okay. He gave the money. And I then met this Rabbi Hershkovitz, who is an expert in a few different areas. He's published Sfarim, published stuff from the Maharal or of Yosef Shaul Natanson. It's just a question I asked him, and he told me the answer to it. We don't need to go into that. It's just really Talmudic. And then the next two, three tshuvot, we don't need to look at either. They're one from Rabbi Yosef Lieberman, who's a big posting in Nebrak, and two from Rav Shmuel Ashkenazi, we spoke about, the great bibliographer, who I just received my three volumes of his collected letters. If you love Jewish books, and bibliography, it'll keep you up at night. Everyone else, it'll put to sleep. I mean, I don't think most people are interested in whether it was published in 1520 or 1540 and these sorts of things. But it does have nuggets of brilliance, not brilliance, nuggets of amazing finds in there, things that he knew that no one else did before computers. And these letters all deal with Nittel. Tourist study on Christmas Eve. And we had the whole class on that, so I don't need to repeat it. I'll just add about Nittel, because afterwards I found out, so someone asked me about Yair Chaim Bachrach, Rabbi Elie Fisher in Israel actually discovered a manuscript, which he has published online, the sections of it, in which the Chavos Yair mentions Nittel. I dealt with that in my classes. And he refers to it as Leil Nittel. So what I said, that the idea of Nittel Nach, calling it Nittel Nach, only comes in later. We see already that even though the Rishonim just call it Nittel, already the Chavos Yair in the 1600s is also calling it Leil Nittel. Leil Nittel is Nittel Nacht. So we don't need to go through these tshuvot, just stuff I did in my class. Now we come to page 321. That's what I meant, that we're now only about 40 pages from the end. And this is Siman Kuf Nun, 150. And this is a letter from the Lubavitch Rebbe, a long letter from the Lubavitch Rebbe. So I need to explain a bit about how is it that the Lubavitch Rebbe is writing letters, two letters, one in English and one in Hebrew. It's the only letter in English. I've been seeing recently, you know, the Lubavitch Rebbe wrote thousands and thousands of letters, and yet they sell them at auction for a lot of money. So I think I need to put it in good folder to keep it, because in case I want to sell it. Well, let me tell you the story about my visit with the Lubavitch Rebbe and what led to it. And we'll see what he says in the letter. I grew up in a place called West Orange, New Jersey, and I live there today. I moved back there after 20 years being other places, living in Boston, Brookline, Cambridge, West Hartford, Scranton, New York City. And I made my way to back to West Orange, about a mile from where I grew up, for the simple reason that it's really the closest community to active community to Scranton. Livingston is really the same thing, West Orange. But if you want really an active Jewish community, this is it. But growing up, there was a man in our town, and his name, well, he still lives in the town, is Rabbi Moshe Herson. Rabbi Moshe Herson, it was originally was a shliach of the Rebbe. He's the head of the rabbinical college in Morristown. That's the one of the big yeshivas for Chabad. They also have a camp I went to one summer, Gan Yisrael, and he is the head of all Chabad in New Jersey. Now, what does that mean, the head of all Chabad in New Jersey? Well, I was looking for pictures of him, exactly his titles, I came across something of interest. Well, as I said, he's the head of it. And I came across the following, that are there two Chabad centers in Monroe? This is Monroe, New Jersey. And it explains that there's only one authorized Chabad center. To be an authorized center, the Chabad headquarters based in Brooklyn must authorize you via its regional director. The regional director of the state of New Jersey is Rabbi Moshe Herson of the Rabbinical College in Morristown. And then it explains that this Rabbi Zaklakovsky is the official shliach. And the other one, and here you have the thing from the based in, is not a real shliach. This Rabbi Spritzer does not, or Rabbi Karlbach, they don't operate under the aegis of Lubavitch World Headquarters. So that's an important role that Rabbi Herson has. He's in charge of all the Chabad in New Jersey, and he obviously was very close to the Rebbe because he ran the rabbinical college for all those years that the Rebbe was alive. It's an interesting thing about the official Chabad, because what does that mean? I mean, Chabad's a name. You can't copyright it. If I all of a sudden become interested in Rishnir Zalman of Ladi and I want to open up a center and say the Chabad center, just like you can have a Kabbalah center, you can have a Chabad center. I don't think there's any validity to a civil suit. So they try to sue them on Bastin, and name's important. If you look, for example, Bubov, when they had this split, they had to go to Bastin, and only one could be Bubov. The other has to be, I think they call it Bubov 45 from 45th Street. But you have all these independent Chabad people who, you know, the Rebbe's not alive. They can do their own thing. They don't recognize. And I think I understand if they want to have a different approach, who's to tell them that they can't be called Chabad? They are Chabad. And but it's not official. And a lot of people don't realize this. For instance, Here, the big Chabad place in Rutgers is not, the Chabad house in Rutgers is huge. I've been there, I've eaten there. They have a lot of people sleep there. They have the dormitory and they raise a fortune. People don't realize it's not an official Chabad. It's one of these rebel Chabads that aren't recognized. But does that matter to the average person? What does the average person know? The rabbi is a Chabad rabbi. The fact that he's not officially recognized, it's of no significance or relevance at all to the people who are at Rutgers or anyone who gives them money. They don't even know what that means. It's not officially recognized. If you look a little deeper, you'll find the answer that this is what you find on non-officially recognized Chabad. The Chabad house in Rutgers is a messianic institution. You do not find this in America at regular recognized Chabad houses. They don't have all this propaganda about the Rebbe as Mashiach. But the Chabad house of Rutgers does. But I've spoken to a number of people and they've told me, well, one of them said he knew all about it, but the others told me that they had no clue and it was never brought up. It was irrelevant. So it's not like the Chabad house in Rutgers is the, like the Chabad house in Florence, Italy, for those who've been with me, or Venice, where they put up a big sign on the door saying, Yechi Adonai Marino Verbeno Melcha Mashiach Lam Va'ed. You could go 4 years at Rutgers and you could eat there every day and not know that it's a center of false messianism and that they are not mainstream Chabad, because they don't put it in your face. That's of interest, I think, to Chabad people, it's of interest. I don't think it's of any interest to us. But Rabbi Herson, let's get back to Rabbi Herson. So growing up, of course, we knew him. He even was Mesader Kiddushin at my brother's wedding. Well, when I became Bar Mitzvah, I don't remember the exact circumstances, but I had Chabad connections because we used to go to Mishmar with Chabad people. And we used to have Shabbatons and Crown Nights. I davened with the Rebbe upstairs in the special room there. And we had Chabad people. The school I went to, which is now called the Kushner Academy, was called the Hebrew Youth Academy. We had Chabad students with us, even though it's a co-ed school. They did not have a school in Morristown like they do today. So all the children, including Rabbi Herson's children, went to this modern Orthodox school until they, I think, were eighth grade or maybe sixth grade. And then they moved them to a Chabad place in Crown Heights. Although the girl I was, Rabbi Zwiebel, very important rabbi in Morristown. His daughter was in my class. We had like eight boys, one girl, just her. Couldn't have been an easy experience. But her father was, I think they called him the head mashpia, as they call it in Morristown. She was with us till eighth grade. And all the Chabad people in Morristown and in the area, there were other Chabad people who lived, they all sent their children for elementary school to the Hebrew Youth Academy. Rabbi Oberlander in Budapest actually discovered this, which I knew nothing about. He's reading old Chabad materials, and lo and behold, here it is. It says South Orange, New Jersey. That's where my school was, although by this time it had moved to West Caldwell. I was in West Orange. But I had no idea that in this Chabad little Torah journal from 1979, one of the Mazel Tovs for the Bar Mitzvahs is me, Mark Shapiro. But so before I was Bar Mitzvahed, I'm not sure if I asked. I know I didn't ask. I'm not sure if my father asked or Rabbi Herson himself did it. He asked, would I like to have Yechidus with the Rebbe? Now understand that Shmini Atzeres of 1977, the Rebbe had a heart attack in the middle of Hakafos, in front of all his Hasidim. And after that, it was not Chabadnikim could go in, but other people did not go in. It was very hard to get in to see the Rebbe. Rabbi Herson, of course, he is one of the leading figures in Chabad. He could make it happen. So he did make it happen. And we had Yechidus with the Rebbe. The Rebbe gave me a dollar. I don't know where the dollar is. I didn't take it seriously. I didn't frame it or anything. When the book came out, you had all these people, there's two of them actually, who contacted me. Tell me about the meeting with the Rebbe. Like I remember 1979, I was there. It's nothing. He talked to my father really. Didn't speak to me. That we'll see the letter. But it was such like a big deal for Chabad because you understand the people, the young Chabad people growing up today, they just know the videos. And I guess they thought it'd be interesting to see what my impressions were of the Rebbe. I was 12 years old at the time. So we went to the Rebbe and we had Yechidus with the Rebbe, which probably lasted, 3-4 minutes. And that was that. However, shortly after that, and we're going to have to do this next class, my parents get a long letter from the Rebbe in English not typed, but with his handwriting, actually. He added in things on the side. Not a typical, just a, you know, the 3-4 line letters. I got the typical 3-4 line letter, which I'll just show you one thing about it, but we'll deal with the letter to my father next class. In the letter to me, which is not a significant letter, it's a standard letter, he just says that, calls me Havrich, Melach Ben Yamin, that now that you're 13 years old is when you're a bar mitzvah, mitzvos, you should grow to Ben Chamesh Esrei, the Mishnah says in Avos, then that's when you do Gemara. And then he says you should increase your learning, B'Torah HaNigla, in the open Torah, and V'chein B'Torah HaChassidus. And he's telling me, this modern Orthodox kid, you should also learn Chassidus, and you know, be careful on Kima Mitzvos. And then he says, Hashem Yisparach Yatzlicha, that God should bring you success. Lios, listen what the Rebbe says. Lios Chassid, Yerei Shemayim, V'lamdan. That you should be a Chassid. And look the order he puts it in. You should be a Chassid, a fear of God, and a Torah scholar. Now, I just Googled it this morning on Otzar HaChachma. This is a standard formula used by the Rebbe. In fact, I even found it, the Rayatz, his predecessor. And you can find this in hundreds of cases. This is what they wish, like when they wish bar mitzvah boys, or they wish others, that you'll grow up, you'll be a Chassid, Yerei Shemayim V'lamdan. But Chassid goes first. And Chassid doesn't mean just a pious, it means a Chassid. So I find that of interest. I know I'm going to have, we have a number of Chabadnikim who listen, especially Nachum, who's, Shemariyahu, who helps me a lot. And he, I'm sure, will have a lot to say about, Nachum Shemariyahu, that's his full name, his first name. He has a double name, Nachum Shemariyahu. I won't give away his last name. If you listen to Rakefet, you've heard his name mentioned numerous times. He's going to have a lot, I'm sure, to tell me about this phrase because he's very learned. But so the Rebbe said I should be. So next week we're going to see what the Rebbe had to say to my parents. In fact, really my father, although he addresses it because my father's a historian. So it's a very interesting letter, what the Rebbe has to say. And then we're going to hear from Herschel Schechter. Information that I don't think till it was written down here was ever recorded. And well, as I said, we're only about 40 pages from the end. So we're making progress. We're not going to go 55. So let me take the questions and the comments here. We'll meet one more time before Pesach. I don't know if I mentioned it. You can listen. I gave the talk last year on Kitnios, so you can hear that if you're interested during the week, Monday night, 2 weeks from tonight, where Israel says that Beryl Lazar's father is the shliach there. Yeah, there's a few people in Milan. The thing about Milan is that they're Beryl Lazar, the chief rabbi of Russia. You have some messianist types there also. So David Berger made a big deal about how can we trust their wine, but Milan has a real Chabad presence there. Yes, and Beryl Lazar's is the brother-in-law of Rabbi Oberlander of Budapest, who, if you ever make your way to Budapest, he is an unbelievable personality. As is Beryl Lazar, what he's been able to accomplish and achieve there is simply incredible. The Misnagdim always like to criticize. I remember during the Olympics, when they had the Olympics there, Rabbi Lazar was invited by Putin. So he went to the opening ceremony and then he flew back. And this was Erev Shabbos. And he couldn't get back to his house. So he walked like 10 miles on Shabbos to get, you know, surrounded by security to get home. So everyone was mocking him. This is a rabbi, you know, Erev Shabbos, he should be home. Instead, he's going to the Olympics. What kind of idiots these people are? If Putin's like the czar, if Putin tells you, I want you to come to the Olympic Games, of course you go there. He'd even have a heter to fly on Shabbos if the games were on Shabbos. There's no question they have a heter because it's pikuach nefesh. If a Jewish person in Israel or someone gets arrested for drug dealing, Putin can reach the Putin can call up the Kremlin and Lazar can call the Kremlin and get put through to Putin. Putin actually sent Lazar to Iran to visit the Jewish community last year. It's real pikuach nefesh. So whatever Putin says to Lazar to do, of course Lazar should do it. You don't tell Putin, I'm not coming to your games. Lazar, and he's done great things in Russia. David says, I didn't continue reading the Midrash that only one man in a thousand will excel in Gemara, while zero women in a thousand. Okay, hold on. It says... Well, because the pasuk is here, they're giving a drasha as follows. Let me pull it up on the screen here for you. So you see what David, thank you again, as always, David, for this. They're making a drasha on, this is Koheles, Ecclesiastes, Perek Zion. So here, take a look at the pasuk here in pasuk 28. It's saying, Koheles is saying, not one man among a thousand have I found, but a woman among those have I not found. Now, whatever the context is in Koheles,
not belong.
The context is Koheles. The Midrash was using it to speak about learning. But then it says, but hold on. But right after they quote the Midrash about the Gemara, then it says another interpretation. I found one man of a thousand, it's Avraham, and a woman among those not found, that's Sarah. But I'm looking at it. I don't see where it says, David, I'm just looking at the Midrash here, where it says that women, no women. I mean, that's the implication, of course, but it doesn't say it explicitly. It's not referring to that. The focus is on the men there learning. Let's go back to the questions here. Scholars do not take, Bell says, do not take Moses' book seriously. And he's not the first one to write a book like that. Yes, they do not take it seriously. Shmuel says, is the Rambam's inauthentic ethical will where the Rambam was reputed to have said the Chachmei Luna's brains were frozen up north? Yeah, that's it. And he says, because they eat all the terrible food. It's all sorts of bad stuff. David says, in Roshom Karmi's Jewish philosophy course, he brought in Zvi Kolitz to deliver a guest lecture on Yossel Rockover. That would be nice to hear. Of course, in those days, they wouldn't have taped it. Then they didn't have children. Someone texted me something about the Chazon Ish and his wife. I will be dealing with the person who this person refers to in a future post. Barry says, Chaim Grada, who was a Talmud of the Chazon Ish, talks about the difficult marriage in his books. Yeah, Tzvi Yehuda, who I'm going to be dealing with, this figure. The Chazon Ish had a student called Tzvi Yehuda. And I'm going to, in my next post, reveal very interesting stuff about this relationship of Tzvi Yehuda and the Chazon Ish. But and anyone who knew the Chazon Ish knew this. And look, it's not that it happens. And who says just because he's a Gadol Bisrael that he has to have a perfect marriage?
We have a talk by Tzvi Yehuda on our website.
Remember, yes, in my post, I link to it.
Oh, okay. Thank you. Okay.
Who was Rachel Margolius' husband from HES? That's Mordechai Margolius. Susanna says there were women composers who had to hide the fact that they were women in order to be published. Yeah, and there was a, in the Haredi world, sometimes what they do is they use the initial. They don't do their full name, they'll use their initial. Ravara Lichtenstein's mother published material in Tells. They had a Torah journal there, and she published it under a pseudonym because it wasn't... appropriate, they thought, for women to be writing Torah stuff. Israel says he heard the story from Nutter Greenblatt, who is probably the sole survivor of the Rav's Kol. You mean, Israel, the story that he woke him up in the middle of the night? I mean, it could be more than one. It might have happened more than once, but I heard it from, I can't remember his name. He's professor of economics at George Mason. Shmuel says, maybe writing, but don't rely on my psak, is a way of setting a quasi-precedent that could be used in subsequent generations. That is, you're convinced of your review, but don't feel the time is right. Well, that's what he says. He says, I leave it here until, what he says is as follows. Rabbi Mazuz says, after giving us all the reasons it should be permissible, he says, but I don't want people to rely on me, ad she'askimu chachmei ador, until the great sages agree with me. And if they don't agree, then it should be halacha of all ma'isa. So that's why I asked Rav Schechter. And he says it makes perfect sense. So then I says, okay, so can I tell people you're mutter at that? He didn't want to. And it's not because he's afraid. Believe me, Rav Schechter says all sorts of stuff that his handlers always have to then retract it and find a way out because they feel it. They don't want him. He has these handlers who have to, you know, he'll say they took out of the website, the Jewish Press website, what I showed you, that he muttered swordfish, even though everyone knows it. He's been saying it for years. So they have these people who protect him, as it were, in quotes. So it's not that he didn't know if he wanted to mutter it, but just because the logic makes sense, you need to think about it. But you're right, what you say, Shmuel, that he's writing it. And but the question of the question of Stechemet is, Stechemet quotes sources that say you can ignore the last piece and just follow everything else. A good example of this, Rav Yecheskel Abramsky has a long tshuva. It's printed in Tzitz Eliezer, I'm not sure, volume 4 or 5, why gelatin is permitted. And at the end, he says, but we can't permit it. Because even though halachically it's permitted, we can't permit it because we've been accustomed not to eat gelatin in this country, talking in England. And people will say that, well, that means halacha changes, just like the conservatives. It raises an interesting question. He's just told you it's permitted. So what happens if you eat it? What if you violate it? But if you look, Chesko Abramsky's tshuva is often quoted by people to support the fact that gelatin's permitted, even though Lamaisa, in the end, he ruled no for metahalachic reasons. And that's in line with the Sadeh Chemet, who says that you can actually, you don't need to listen to the end, because you could say that that only refers to that time, or he's just hesitant, but we accept him, even though he doesn't want to accept himself. Barry says, Pinchas Scheinberg was Talmud of Rav Moshe Soloveitchik, from whom he received smicha, and then graduated Brooklyn College and married a girl from Herman Valley, and went to Mir. I didn't know that he received from smicha from Rav Moshe Soloveitchik. I didn't know that that's who he received smicha from. Okay, I knew he went there, but I didn't know it was Rav Moshe. He had other people. I thought it was the Mechitur, but let me look online quickly here. Oh, it says Rav Moshe Soloveitchik. Yes, and I'm just looking at Wikipedia. Rabbi Victor Miller was there, Rav Moshe Bick, Rav Mordechai Gifter, and Rabbi Wachtfogel. He's from Lakewood. Someone privately says that the warning in the Binyan Tzion was added by the publisher. Well, that's the Sun. The Sun published it. So you could say that maybe it's just the Sun, it's not the Binyan Tzion. Could be. Barry says that Rabbi Bach of Baltimore told us the story of the Rav waking the kids up at 2 a.m. He went to, it probably was more than once, because I don't think they were all there at the same time. David says that Dr. Aviat Stolman is the person who hired Dr. Yoel Finkelman. Ah, but he's not there anymore at the library. He's at Bar-Ilan there. Oh, very nice. Thank you for correcting that. He also has a PhD, and he wrote on Talmud. I think it's Maseches Eruvin, if I'm not mistaken. He studied with Shama Friedman, but he's also a Rav, and he wrote a volume of Shelos and Chuvos. Mel says, Zugot, we're in Daf Yomi a few days ago. Et Chatai Ani Maskir, I don't do Daf Yomi. From Washington Avenue to Washington Street. Thank you. iPad says that JTS put in tables with glass tops because of the liberation theft issue in this renovation. There's a very nice video with David Kramer, who's the librarian, discussing how they have to reimagine libraries in the digital age. Israel says, with the Kozimer Hasidim admit publicly they visited JTS? I don't know, but why not? He's going there to get the manuscripts. Manuscripts are always published, and they always thank in the introduction the seminary for letting them. And all these people have to go to the seminary to see it. I've seen other great Torah scholars at the seminary. You're going to the library. You're going to look at the manuscripts. Look, we go to the Vatican to see manuscripts. Baruch says that the largest Chabad house in the world, that's Rutgers, is the largest one in the world. I don't know if it is. Is official Chabad and unofficial depend on Messianic views? What I was told is that none of the official ones are Messianic. But I think even if you're not Messianic, if you just decide to open up a Chabad house and say, I'm going to open a Chabad house, and you don't have Rabbi Herson's approval, then you're unofficial. But the idea that then they're going to bring you to Beis Din because you don't have the right, I don't know who can copyright Chabad as a philosophy. Just like I could open up and say, I'm a Satmar or I'm a Litvish or something. I guess if you're a Chabad person, this is a personal thing. And it's distressing if you're like a mainstream Chabad that these independent people are opening and they're not in line with the mainstream or opening up and calling it Chabad. But for outsiders who just want kosher meals and a Shabbos, I was in India. You think the people, these independent ones in New Jersey, are maybe a little bit off. You go to India, they're completely whacked out, even though they have amazing Mesiris Nefesh to live in India. But I published this on the Sfarim blog. I opened up the Sfarim. They have a stamp there saying that the date, what is it, Gimel Tammuz, nothing happened. Everything is the same. They believe the grave is empty. I mean, you have some real craziness going in India. Zev says Rabbi Kaufman was my Hasidus teacher at the Bava Shiva Newark in 1963. Yes, so Howard says Hasid Yirei Shamayim. Sometimes they write Chayal. They abbreviate it, correct. And you're Chayal in the Army of Hashem. When I was in Gan Yisrael day camp, we were all inducted. We got our flags, and we were inducted in Sivos Hashem, in the Army of Hashem. And we sang, "We want Mashiach now." And we did not sing about the Rebbe. This was in the mid-70s. We did not have the Rebbe in mind. Maybe in the secret, that's what they thought. But they never, ever told us anything about the Rebbe as Mashiach. So Naftali says that Binyamin Brown's book on the Chazon Ish, I showed you that book, the big one, discusses the shidduch and the marriage and quotes Kolitz extensively. And it shows the Chazon Ish's sitkus. I'm sure he mentions it as well, that the Chazon Ish was deceived about her age. And when he found out, he refused to break the shidduch. And there might have been other issues. And they never had children. He refuses to embarrass her. And I mean, that's told about what a tzaddik he is. That's beyond the call of duty, obviously, but that's the Chazon Ish. We're not all the Chazon Ish. David says that when Rav Aaron Lichtenstein was walking in Crown Heights in the 50s, he crossed the Rebbe as they were walking, and after a brief exchange, the Rebbe reminded Rav Aaron Lichtenstein that Yiraso Kodemus Chachmaso, so you're in good company. But it's one thing that Yira should go first, but Chasidus. What am I planning to do in these classes when I finish viewing a Sefer? Well, the plan was that someone important suggested it. Do Shaul Lieberman. Take you into the world of American Orthodoxy and conservative Judaism. There's a lot to do about Shaul Lieberman. And Baruch says, who gave the heter to fly to the Olympics on Shabbos? No one gave the heter to fly to the Olympics on Shabbos. The Olympics weren't on Shabbos. It was Erev Shabbos. What I said was that if the first day of the Olympics was, let's say, on a Friday night, and the only way... Or let's say it was a two-day holiday, and the only way to get there was to violate it or something like that. Whatever it is, I have no doubt there'd be a heter for it. It's only a derabanan, and this is a case that would be pukuach nefesh. If Putin were to send a car, let's say it's Shabbos afternoon, and Putin's car rolls up and says that it's urgent. Putin says that Rabbi Lazar has to come to him. You think any posek would say, of course, Lazar could get in the car and go there. It could be a matter of pikuach nefesh. We have no idea how many Jewish lives and important matters Rabbi Lazar, because of the fact that he can pick up the phone and call Putin, how much good he has done. And we know there's all sorts of a terror for people who are close to the Melech. So I'm just saying, hypothetically, if that was the case, that you could definitely find a heter for that much easier than all these other heterim for people who work in government. Lazar's congregation might be small, but he controls the entire former Soviet Union, and it's all Chabad. Other than a shul here and a shul there, it's all Chabad. Someone puts it, Rabbi Gorelick was the Chabad in Milan. Yes, he passed away. David says, regarding Rabbi Lamb typing one of the holy names, many poskim say that any writing such as typing, which is not kosher as her Sefer Torah, is not prohibited writing, and he gives sources. Okay, so thank you for that. So you wouldn't need to, if it's not type of, and you know, this also relates to the question I spoke about Bethel. Remember the old question about Bethel? If you write Bethel, it's not in Hebrew. That was the question. Could you do it or not? And we spoke about it. And Mel says he attended classes given by Tzvi Yehuda at BRS in Boca. Yes, I will deal more, as I said, with Tzvi Yehuda. Rabbi Wachtfogel was a student. Rav Nosson Wachtfogel was a student at Yeshiva College. The Rav Cook biography. The Rav Cook biography is done. We just got these academic books are not like books that where you just finish it and you then publish it. You have readers and you have other things. And okay, everyone, thank you. We'll wait one more class before Pesach. We'll pick up with the Lubavitcher Rebbe's letter to my family. Rabbi Kelman, take it away.
All right, thank you.